We are in Acts chapter 27 tonight. We are making our way towards the end of the book of Acts here. We come to this section here where it says, "And when it was decided that we should set sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment." Paul was very familiar with sea travel. Sea travel was something that was very common in Paul's day in the Roman Empire, therefore travelers to kind of make their way across the Mediterranean. There wasn't really the ships that we would think of today. You know, there weren't cruise liners that you kicked back on the deck and someone came and served you, you know, there by the pool, and there was the all-you-can-eat buffets. Very different for Paul. But he was familiar with it. In fact, if you take all of Paul's sea travels in the book of Acts, you could count about a dozen of them. A dozen different times that he went out over a period of about three decades and covering about 3,000 miles of sea travel. So though Paul wasn't a sailor, he was certainly familiar with them. And, you know, the waters got very rough out there in the Mediterranean, and boats and ships weren't like they are today. And we know that Paul declares there in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he says there in verse 25, he says there that he was, shipwrecked three times, and a night and a day he had spent in the deep. Think about that. I mean, this was written before Paul is going to board this ship here, which will ultimately end in disaster for the ship and the cargo. So Paul is loaded on here with a few other prisoners. Now, we do learn here, if you read verse 1 carefully, you will note that Paul is there with Luke. We know that because the "we" passages, we've seen these before, come up again. And so they come up here. And Neil, if you just want to throw up that picture of one of that boat there. So this is a typical boat in Paul's day, very large vessel, the vessel that Paul would have been on. We do know, according to chapter 27 here, that there is some 200, I think it's 267 people were on board. So it was a large vessel. Going out there on the sea, basically a sailboat. If the winds weren't favorable, you were in trouble. Well, Luke is with him. Luke is known as a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. He traveled with him and, was a faithful minister to him. Again, we know Luke from the book of Colossians was a physician. He's called the beloved physician. So he was a doctor. That's nice to have with you, especially out there on the sea. And some other prisoners, it says. And then verse 2 says, So entering a ship of Adramedium, we put to sail, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. So we also know that with Luke, there was this man named Aristarchus. He was from the area of Thessalonica, the kind of the county of Macedonia. We know that he was one of the faithful travelers with Paul. He's already been mentioned twice here in the book of Acts, and there in Colossians, he is mentioned in chapter 4, there in verse 10, as well as the traveling companion and fellow prisoner of Paul. Now, when Paul writes the book of Colossians, it's later on. It's after he gets to Rome. He's there in prison, and he's called a fellow prisoner. He very well sold himself. Luke and Aristarchus very possibly sold themselves into slavery to the Apostle Paul so that then they could travel with Paul. That is one theory that does come up, and interesting. But these men are there to serve Paul. as he goes to Rome. They're risking their own lives. We saw this in Philippians, how there were those like Epaphroditus there in the end of Philippians 2, where Paul speaks about how he risked his own life to supply what was lacking on the behalf of the Philippian church, bringing Paul their supplies and whatnot while he was there in Rome as a prisoner, as Philippians is one of those prison epistles. So some pretty awesome guys. I mean, some real committed bros that are alongside of Paul here. But it says here that they pick up this ship and they're planning to sail along the coast of Asia. And Neil, if you could just throw that map up for us as we will be taking a look at that here tonight. This is not Paul's fourth missionary journey. Paul has had three missionary journeys. We have seen those before, but this is Paul's more voyage to Rome. He's not necessarily a free man saying, hey, let's go to this city and preach the gospel there. He's a prisoner. He's a prisoner of Rome, being carried by this centurion Julius. He's being taken there from the region of Jerusalem, or the region of Caesarea, I should say, there in Israel, all the way to Rome. He's taken as a prisoner, but Paul is always on a mission. Okay, so though it's not his missionary journey, he's a missionary on a journey. He is a missionary to those that are on the ship with him, those that he comes in contact with as they port. Those even we'll see when in chapter 28, when they shipwrecked on the island of Malta, he's there ministering. A revival breaks out led by the prisoner Paul. It's awesome to see that when God is your Lord, he's in control, even when it looks like others are in control. Even though Paul seemingly was under the control of the Romans, well, by the way, the Romans and the sea and the currents and the weather were under the control of the Lord, and he placed Paul right where he wanted to place him and used him. But the thing about Paul is he was a man who always was looking for an opportunity to share the gospel. He wasn't worried in, having a pity party. Look at me now, I'm in prison, and here I am as a, locked up here and on this ship going to Rome, to stand before Caesar and my trial there. But he saw everything as an opportunity to minister. What a great characteristic. Something that convicts me, something that I know we need to always be, seeking the Lord about is in our trials, in our difficulties in life, that we ought not to lose sight of the Lord and his work that he wants to do with the people around us. And, that's really what helps us to, and what helped Paul to have that joy in the midst of his difficult situations, that he is able to seek the Lord and trust the Lord and take the opportunities that presented themselves to him. And we will see that he does that very well here. I'm reminded of Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor, as many of you know, was a young man born in London there in England, and felt a call by God as a very young man, 19 years of age, got on a ship and made his way to China. Became one of the greatest pioneer missionaries ever in missions history, and certainly the greatest pioneer missionary to China that this world has ever seen. God used him in tremendous ways. But like Paul, he always saw people not for what he could get from them, but for what he could give to them. His first voyage to China, he barely made it. He was in a storm like Paul. And he writes in his journal, and it's written down. And some of us went through Spiritual Secrets by Hudson Taylor last summer as our men's group. We kind of went through that book, and it just awesome stories there about how he just recounts the reality and how the seas were lifting up and dropping down, and just how they had given up hope of life. And it was Hudson Taylor in the midst of it all that was able to not only be spared by God, but to be concerned for. He says, in the midst of one of the greatest storms, and all hope was lost, and he was talking to the captain, who was a believer, and he was saying, you know, asking him questions like, can we do this? Can we go there? You know, could we, you know, use the life boats, you know? And the captain's like, no, no, no. And he says, you know, but by God's, you know, providence and his hand, we're dead. And, you know, Hudson Taylor shares how his heart was scared. He was concerned for his own life. But more than that, he was concerned for all of the crew members on the ship that didn't know the Lord. I mean, just what a perspective in the middle of, a time like that. You know, it's easy to sit here tonight in the sanctuary and talk about how we ought to keep our focus on Jesus in the storm. It's another thing to be in the storm and to keep your focus like that on the Lord. But we see that God enables us as we seek Him in the sanctuary to prepare us for the storms of life. And we see that in Paul, as we will read on here. So, verse 3, the next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. And when we had put to sea from there and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, so that's the island of Cyprus, it says, because the winds were contrary. So here they are, Caesarea, going to Sidon, then making their way under the shelter there of Cyprus and making their way. Just follow that map as we read. And when we had, verse 5, sailed over the sea, which was off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy and put us on board. So they come here to this city right here of Myra, and they find another ship. Now, you need to know the Alexandrian ship. Alexandrian is from Egypt. Here is Alexandria right here. Alexandria was considered the breadbasket to the Roman Empire, meaning that the grain there, and we will see this is a ship that is carrying cargo, carrying grain. They would bring grain up to Rome, up to Italy there, supplying the capital there of the Roman Empire with grain. Grain, you know, the wheat grew along the shores there of the Nile River, plentiful. And so they would load these ships and fill these ships with just several tons of grain, and they would be carrying them. So this is the kind of ship that Paul will be on. Again, it's not the cruise liner. It's not even the fishing boat. But it is a grain ship that's being carrying grain. And so the centurion finds this one there, and they put them on board, verse 7. And when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, then the winds not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete. Passing it with difficulty, we came to the place called Fair Haven, near this city. You can pronounce the cities if you want to. So they come over here. They come here off Cnidus. They make their way down here, and they come to the middle of the island of Crete, their Fair Haven. So Crete, we learn of Crete, the Cretans in the book of Titus, where Paul talks there to Titus about remaining in Crete and they're ordaining elders in all the cities there. So there is certainly a work when he writes the book of Titus. Now, Titus is certainly written after this time he's come through. We don't know how the churches got there. Luke doesn't record some, you know, big revival there. He wasn't there long enough, I'm sure, to plant any churches. It says that they're there in a place called Fair Haven. Now, when much time had been spent, and sailing was now dangerous because the feast was already over, Paul advised them. What feast is he speaking of? That would be the Feast of Atonement, which is when they would fast And this is during the fall time. This is like September, October. Anytime after this, you would not sail at all. And by the way, Crete here. Why are they going? Why don't they just go to Italy? You know, why don't they just go straight across? The reason is because of the weather. And so what they're doing is they're jogging around, staying close to all of these land. And here in the area of Corinth, you see these three horns, they call them. It's called the Cape of Malea. There at the base of Corinth, the base there of Greece. It is the most dangerous place to sail. It is called the graveyard of sailors. This is the place where the sailors, before they would go, and we have their actual wills that they've written. They always say, write your will before you sail Cape Malea, especially at this time. So that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get away from this cape. And over here is called the Sardis Sands. We'll see them. This is another graveyard, bunch of reefs there. When ships get out in the middle of the Mediterranean, the storms come, they get tossed over there, and many, many of ships have been discovered in this area. Even recently in the last, century, many ships have been discovered there, and they found them because of all the shipwrecks. So, Paul, remember now, Paul, though he's not a sailor by any means, he's certainly experienced with sailing. He's certainly experienced with being out there. Again, he's trucked some 3,000 miles on the Mediterranean Sea. And so he says in verse 10, "Man, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul." Now, of course, I mean, here's the centurion. You've got the helmsman, the captain, if you would. You've got the owner of the ship, the professionals here saying, we can do it. And you've got the prisoner. It's funny that we're even having a conversation right now that Paul had a voice. But we saw here that Julius was kind to Paul. We saw that he gave him favor. Somehow Paul and his personality won him over to just befriend him. You know, I love that. I think that's so important that you and I as believers are able to befriend even Roman centurions, if you would. I mean, here's a guy who is everything anti to a Jew, everything anti to Christianity, and here's Paul being friends with them. We see this as a theme throughout the book of Acts, where Paul had friends. It was there in Ephesus where the city clerk says was Paul's friend. And, so here Paul has this ability here to talk to him, this ability to share his thoughts and his concerns. But the centurion doesn't listen to Paul. And it says, because the harbor, verse 12, was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there, and if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening towards the southwest and the northwest, and winter there. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to winter. They wanted to wait out the winter. And, this would happen. You know, it wasn't always just easy to say, okay, we're going to track this and we'll be here by this time and here by this time. You know, when we travel today, we have our itineraries down to the minute. You know, when I travel, I'm getting ready to do a trip over to India. And, you know, we've got our itinerary. We know when the plane's supposed to land. And, you know, we complain a lot. You know, we have a delay. I mean, we have like an hour delay, a 2-hour delay. I mean, a 3-hour delay. You know, and we're sitting there in an airport and we're crying and whining. Next time I do that, if you're with me, remind me of Paul, okay? Because these guys had weeks of delays, months of delays,
weather delays. You know, we're crying about, you know, when the plane is grounded because there's fog, and you know, and this is where they are. Now, they, you know, as we often might do, those of us that have ever traveled, certainly internationally or even nationally, you know, we're sitting in an airport thinking they should get me a hotel. You know, there's not, you know, proper accommodations here for me. Paul and these guys, that's what they're saying here. Now, Paul's not saying it, but the rest of the crew, the majority there, is saying, listen, Fairhaven just doesn't have much. It's not really a big city. And if we're going to spend a month or 2 months there and we're going to wait this thing out, then let's go to somewhere where, you know, we can hang out. A place where, you know, we can have our comforts. And that's what they were concerned about. They were concerned about their own comforts and taking care of themselves. Paul says, I don't think it's wise to do that. And so we find here that they say, let's go over there to Phoenix. And this harbor, it's a bigger harbor. It's got a better opening. It's better to winter in. So right here, over here in Phoenix, that's where we're going to go. And so they take off to go over there. And it says, and when, verse 13, the south winds blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, putting out to sea, they sailed closely by Crete. So they're like, okay, things are good. It's perfect. The wind is blowing softly. Remember, these are sailboats, so you need the right winds. You can't have too strong of wind, but you need wind to move. So they think, okay, this is working out. But not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euryclidon. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Clotus, we secured the skiff with difficulty. And when they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship, and fearing lest they should run aground on the Sardis sands, they struck sail and so were driven. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day we lightened the ship. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. But after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them, saying, let's just stop there for a second and see what's going on here. So they're making their way. They're like, we're going to go, you know, and then this tempest arrives. Now, it's called here Euryclidon. It's a transliteration of a Greek word that simply refers to northern eastern winds. And it's where we get our word typhoon from. It's where we get our English. We are talking about, basically, it's winds that are coming from every direction and circling. It's not just like a wind blowing you straight, but it's winds hitting you from all sides. It's this whipping kind of wind. And so they're like, we'll go under the shelter then of this little island. And you probably can't see it, but it's right here. There's this little island. So they're going to try to go under the shelter, but they're just tossed. They have no ability. Now, if you know anything about boats, which I don't, if you've ever sailed at all, this chapter is certainly very interesting to those that have a little insight. Luke gives a lot of details here. Now, he speaks here about how they basically take the sails down. They bring the sails down because the way these ships were built is that there was one giant mast, there was one giant sail, and there were some other side ones, but the main one, if it was ripped too hard, it would literally rip the ship apart. And that's why here, now you see him putting these cables or these ropes around the ship. I want you to picture this. Here they are. They're out here in something that would be comparable to a typhoon. And they're wrapping this huge ship that's got a ton of cargo and grain in it. You know, just tons and tons of weight. It's got 276 people on board. And they're wrapping it and they're holding it together with cables. And then it says here that they did not see the sun or the stars for many days. We learn here that they didn't eat, they couldn't eat. I don't know if you've ever been on a ship and been seasick, but something you can't do when you're seasick is eat. Okay, I don't know that they're fasting willfully, but they can't eat. I can remember one time as a young boy, I was with my friend. We went up north, and we were with his dad, and we went out on a small little boat. We went out fishing up there out on the ocean, and boy, you know, it was about a half hour into it, and I wasn't doing good. I was hanging over the side of that boat and just praying for land. That's all I cared about. I mean, it was so miserable. And, another time, I remember we went out on a fishing boat out of Davy's Locker, those of you that have been out, on a boat out of there. And I can remember, I just, you know, the sea started getting rough, and it was not a pretty sight. There, I didn't do much fishing. I was spending time right by the trash can. And, you know, that's what's going on. Obviously, this is far, far worse. That's what's going on. And so, Paul will say later on here in this chapter that it's been 14 days since we've eaten. So this is going on for 14 days. Remember, the stars and the sun and the moon is how they navigate. That's how they know where they are. They have no idea where they are. They are just being tossed to and fro out at sea. And you know what? What strikes me here is when we think about the Lord saving his people, when we think about the miracles of the Lord, oftentimes I want to tell God, this is what you need to do, Lord. You need to save me. And I don't know if Paul had the inclination to stand up on the deck there and say, Jesus did it. I'm going to do it. You know, waves cease. You know, why not? Jesus calm the storm. Why couldn't Paul? I mean, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be such a great witness? Wouldn't everyone on the ship get saved if they're all out there and spend a few days? You know, let the pain settle in. Let the storm, you know, affect them. And then just get up and just say, boom, this is how it's going to be. But, you know, God doesn't work the same way in every situation. And though we think, man, this is the way God should work. And oftentimes, to be honest, we struggle with doubting because the Lord doesn't come through like we think he should. Like maybe we see certain ways he's done in other times or in the scriptures. And we struggle with that. You know, our faith needs to be in the Lord. Our faith can't be in a miracle. Our faith can't be in, you know, a situation. And we certainly don't want to make things up. We certainly don't want to think, well, the Lord wants me to do this, unless indeed the Lord wants him to do this. Now, Paul, no doubt he waited on the Lord. And he was one of these guys that hadn't eaten. And no doubt he felt the pain and the sickness and all of that just as much as anyone else, just like Jesus did. You know, a lot of times we think, well, Jesus was Jesus when he went to the cross. He didn't suffer the pain like you and I would because he's Jesus. But indeed he did. The scriptures teach us very clearly that he suffered the pain, just like you and I suffer the pain. Sometimes we think, you know, he was kind of exempt. No one is exempt. Jesus says it this way. Listen, the rain falls upon the just and the unjust alike. We aren't taken away from trials. We aren't spared from the tragedies even of life. But God has given us a hope in the midst of it. God has given us a relationship with him that he is able to navigate us through those trials. We always say the prayer shouldn't be in the midst of a trial, Lord, get me out of this. But the prayer should be, Lord, get me through this. But that's a relationship. If you don't have a relationship with the Lord, You're going to get bitter. You're going to, and how many times have I seen it? You're going to say, God, I prayed, and I asked you to calm the storm. I asked you to do this, and you didn't do it. So you're not real. And we oftentimes forget who God is. He's God. We're not. I don't tell the Lord, this is what you're going to do, and if you don't do it, I'm not going to follow you. That doesn't work. But you see, what we do is we say, God, here I am. I'm helpless. I'm hopeless. All I have is you. The only one that can rescue me now, the only one that can deliver me is you. And you say, why am I in this situation? Sometimes we're in those situations because God wants to show himself strong. And sometimes we're in these situations and we think, this is horrible. And God has forsaken me. And the reality is God is right there. But we've got to seek him. And we've got to trust him. And we have to stop commanding him of what he's supposed to do. And we need to start walking with him. And saying, Lord, what do you want me to do? And you know, Paul, he's secure in his salvation. I mean, he's no doubt ready to go home. Hudson Taylor shares about in one of those, that first storm he was in, he was actually in several, but that first storm he was in, how, you know, the captain said, he said to the captain, do we have an hour or two? He says, I don't know that we have that long to wait. And so he writes his address down, he writes some things down, and kind of puts them in a sealed container there, hoping that if he died, someone would find it. He kind of said, this is it, I'm ready. He faced the reality that I'm ready. And he said after he did that, God gave him this peace. This just peace. He was ready to meet his maker. He had accepted whatever it was that the Lord had for him. You know, at the end of his story, obviously, as he writes it, is, you know, the Lord spares him, and just by God's grace and a shift of the wind as they were praying, the Lord brought them safely to land. And you know, God's ways aren't our ways, but God is there. And so here's Paul, and Paul's seeking the Lord, and Paul is asking, no doubt, God to spare him and all that are traveling with him. And it says here that verse 21, let's pick it up there again. It says, but after a long abstinence of food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, men, you should have listened to me. I mean, I told you so. I love this. I mean, you think Paul's just this holy guy and this humble guy, and he just comes out, he just kind of has to say it. You know, there's sometimes, and I'm not condoning it, but there's sometimes it just comes out like, man, you should have listened to me. I told you so. And that's what Paul does here. He doesn't dwell on it, doesn't remain there. But remember back there in verse 10, he said, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. Now, if you look at that closely, half of it's right. And back there in verse 10 is not necessarily a prophetic word. It very well could be a sense Paul has from the Lord that this won't end well. And Paul just says logically, listen, I'm afraid that this will end in disaster of the ship and loss of everything and our lives. Now we will learn their lives will be spared, but everything else will be lost. But Paul just says here, I told you so. You should have listened to me. And then he says, and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve. What beautiful words we have here, where Paul says this, and no doubt it's now been at least 14 days, and we'll see that here in a minute. They haven't eaten. They've been out there. All hope is lost. They've given up hope. Everyone's ready to die. And Paul's still seeking the Lord. And God reveals himself. God reveals himself to him through an angel. And he's able to confidently, and now again, remember, here's the prisoner. Now he's directing the entire ship. Okay, he's like, you guys, I know you're the professional sailors. I gave you my advice. You rejected it, and we're in this situation. You want to listen to me now? You know, that's what he's saying. You want to listen to me now? Because I'm listening to the God of creation. You know, that's the sweet thing about walking with the Lord. The sweet thing about walking with the Lord is it's not about us. It's about who He is. It's about Him. And He is in control. Even when it seems like He has forgotten us, even when you feel like He's forsaken you, He is in control. And He's got a plan. And so He comes with His plan here. And I love in verse 23, He says, "For there stood by me an angel last night of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve." Do you see yourself like that? Do you see yourself as belonging to God or God belonging to you? Now think about that. Again, that's the two ways we approach, and oftentimes trials reveal this. The two ways we approach God. God belongs to me, and He owes me something. He owes me to get me out of this. He owes me something. God owes me nothing. In fact, if we want to get into debt and owing, God owes me hell. The wages of sin is death. That's what God owes me. But He has given me, by His grace, salvation, His Son. He gave His Son up for me. And through that, He has bought me by His blood. That's what the Scriptures teach us, that we were bought, owned. God bought us out of sin, bought us out of the world. We're His. I could simply say that God is my master, and He can do with my life whatever He pleases to do. I want you to think about that. Whatever He wants to do. He doesn't owe me anything. And the way you see this is the way you're going to deal with trials. Either you're going to come out of trials bitter because you feel like God owes you something and you feel like He didn't pay up, or you're going to come out of trials better because you realize you're owned by God and you're submitted to Him and you let Him bring about His purposes and His will, and then you are able to see what He has. How is it that you come out of trials, bitter or better? And that's a question only you can answer. But you can come out better. God teaches us throughout Scripture that trials were certainly made to make us better. That's the whole point of them. That's what James says. It's kind of all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith is going to produce in you patience, and patience is going to have its perfect work, and you're going to be perfect. The word perfect is mature, complete. You're going to be full. You're going to be whole. You're going to be better. You're going to be better. And that's what God wants to do. But we must trust Him. We must surrender to Him. We must see Him as the owner and as the master, and not see ourselves as some kind of a master of some kind of an owner of God. He says, "The God to whom I belong," and because he knew he belonged to God, he says, "And the God to whom I serve." When you realize that you belong to God, then you willfully and joyfully become the servant of God. There's no greater thing in this life than to serve the Lord. You will find the fulfillment that you're longing for when you serve the Lord. When you realize He's my master, I want Him to be my master. I want Him to own me because I'm safer in His hand than anywhere else. I'm certainly safer in His hand than I am in my hand. His wisdom is far greater than my wisdom, and on you go. I mean, you just walk through it logically, and you're like, of course I want the God of love to own me, and therefore, because He owns me, He's my master, I'm His servant. And it's not a forced servanthood. It's not a, I've got to do this to make God happy so He doesn't get me. But it's a joyful servanthood. I belong to Him. And I want to serve Him. And that's what Paul's saying, even in the midst of where he is. Out at sea, ready to die. He says, I belong to Him and I'm His servant. But the Lord revealed to me through this vision of an angel. No one's going to die. This is great. Great news I'm bringing to you. Verse 24, saying, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all who sail with you. So, Paul, I've got a will for your life. Now, if you remember the story when Jesus told his disciples to get in a boat, and he said, I'll meet you on the other side. Go to the other side. And they go to the other side, and on their way there, they get caught in a storm. And it's there then, they're worried and fretting in the storm, and Jesus walks out on the water, and it's there where they think he's a ghost, and then he says to Peter, come on out, and Peter walks on the water and comes to him, and then when Peter takes his eyes off of Jesus and puts his eyes on the waves, he begins to sink. Now, Jesus already told him you'd go to the other side. God had already told Paul, you're going to Rome. There's that courage, though it seems like I'm not going to make it. It's not going to work. How am I getting there? We're going to die. But God told me I'm going to Rome. And God, in his grace, knowing our frailty, knowing our weaknesses, he brings that angel, he brings that vision, he brings that word. And that word comes to Paul and says, listen, as I said before, I'll say it again. You're going to stand before Caesar. That's where I'm sending you. And I'm going to save you. I'm going to spare you. And by the way, because of you, everyone else on that ship will be spared as well. You see, that's the beautiful thing. And Hudson Taylor speaks about that in many of his journals, about how that because of the Christians that were on board, God saved the crew. Because God had a plan for that you know, missionary team that was on their way to China, God spared the crew. The crew knew it because the missionaries were praying. The missionaries were preaching. Hudson Taylor was passing out tracts in the middle of a storm. I mean, and they knew his God will spare us. His God will bring us through. Hudson Taylor shares about a story when actually the wind wasn't blowing, but a current came, and he was doing a Sunday morning service, as he did there on the deck of the ship. And he noticed the captain, who was this Christian guy, looking over for, could tell that he was a little worried. During the service afterwards, he learned that though there was no wind, there was a current, and that current was quickly taking them to this area where there was reefs, and no doubt they would crash there. And unless the wind came, there would be no way that they would survive that day. And so after, you know, investigating, after doing everything physically and practically they could do to help the crew, to figure out what they could do, Hudson Taylor said, well, there was me, and there was the captain, and the second guy in command, and one other guy that were Christians. There was only four of us that were actual Christians on the ship. And so he said to him, he said, listen, we're four of us are Christians. We've done everything we could do. Why don't we go to our cabins and pray? And so they did. And he shares how that God had so spoken to him when he was in prayer and given him a peace that he said, I don't need to pray. He goes up to the deck. He tells the guy to open the sail. Now, there was no wind. He says, open the sail. Well, this guy, he's looking at him saying, listen, this is what I do for a living. I'm not opening the sail. I'm not a fool. I'm not an idiot. It will do nothing. And he says, listen, the God to whom basically I belong and serve told me he's bringing a wind. Open the sail. And right when he said that, the sail that was closed up just went in the wind. And he says, well, that was just a little puff. Because they would have those, just a little flurry of wind. That's nothing. And he says, I'm telling you, open the sail. And he puts such pressure on him, the guy opens the sail. And as he opens the sail, right away, the sail caught. And the ship took off in the exact direction it needed to. And God spared them. God spared that crew because there was four Christians on board. And I would probably venture to say because Hudson Taylor was on that ship, and God had a plan for his life, and it was carrying him somewhere. And when he, along that road, he wanted to just show, I'm still here. I'm the one in control. I'm the one carrying you. I'm the one that's going to bring you along. And that's exactly what God is doing here with the Apostle Paul. Therefore, take heart, verse 25. Men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. I love that. I believe God. What He says, I believe it. Corrie ten Boom, it's what she said. She said, God said it, that settles it, I believe it. I love it. She was that great saint that was in those Nazi, you know, concentration camps, and God brought her and her sister through so much, and eventually her sister died, but she got released, and she went on to speak. She actually died here in Placentia in the end of her life. And you know, she would say that. She would just say, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. Why is it that we argue? God said it, but it doesn't really mean what He said. God said it, but it's for someone else. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. It's done. It's a done deal. And that's what Paul says here. However, we must run aground on a certain island. So the Lord gave them directions. Now I want you to see the sovereignty of God and the practicality and responsibility of men. Because this passage, and we're running out of time, so we're going to have to move through it, but this passage here reveals that. It's a beautiful tension here between God said it, God's going to do it, this is God's will. But to see it come to pass, you've got to do this. And so directions begin to come. So we need to run aground on a certain island. But when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. So again, 14 nights, day and night, without the sun, moon, stars, just tossed to and fro out there in that sea. And the sailors sensed that there was land. And they took soundings and found it to be 12 fathoms, or 20 fathoms, which is about 120 feet. And these are soundings. They're ropes with these big weights on them, with oil on the bottom of the weight, like a kind of a gummy oil on the bottom, so that they would know when it hit the bottom, would they bring it up, there'd be debris upon the bottom, sand, whatnot, on the bottom of these weights. Then they would know how long the rope was and how deep it was, and so they could tell they were getting closer. And so it says here, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms, about 90 feet. Then fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern, that there is the stern, the back of the boat, and prayed for day to come. Now this isn't a biblical prayer. This is a hoping and wishing. Okay, this isn't Paul. This is the sailors. They're just hoping. Obviously, you pray for a day to come. Day's going to come when day's going to come. But they're just holding on. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea under pretense that they were putting out anchors from the prow, that is the front of the ship, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes from the skiff and let it fall off. Now, I want you to see this. But what's Paul saying? The God to whom I belong and to whom I serve, He stood by me last night. And He says that we're going to lose the ship and all the cargo, but not one soul is going to be lost. Not one person's going to die. And then now he turns and says to these, to the centurion and the soldiers, listen, if those guys get out of here, you're not going to make it. And you can say, well, that's a contradiction. No. What that is again, here is God saying, you're going to make it, do this and do that. If you don't follow directions, you're not going to see God's ultimate plan. And that's something we need to really think through. We've got to follow God's word. We've got to follow the course He's called us to. How many things have we missed? How many things that God has wanted to do in our lives, but we never followed it through? We never saw it come to pass because we got off the path. We got off track. And so, verse 32, then the soldiers cut off the ropes and the skiff fell in and let it fall off. And so it falls there into the sea. And as the day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have waited and continued without food and ate nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival." Again, that idea. Hey, he's practical. It's not like, well, God's sovereign, so we haven't eaten, you know, and we've been seasick for 14 days. Don't worry about it. Who cares? God's going to get us there. But he's practical. He's, take nourishment, for this is for your survival. Since not a hair of your head will fall from the ground of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread, gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broke it, he began to eat. I love it. I mean, he says, eat, guys. He grabs a bread and just says, Lord, we thank you. And he starts worshiping the Lord. We thank you for what you're going to do and for the nourishment that you've given to us. I mean, here's a guy who's been out at sea for 14 days, you know, at the point of death, and he's breaking bread and worshiping God. What an interesting prisoner they have on board. They've never seen anything like it. This is a witness. This is what God wants us to do. He wants us to live our lives in the midst of life and trials for him in the presence of them all. And that's how oftentimes the Lord ministers to people. Then they were all encouraged and also took food for themselves. And in all were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw over the wheat into the sea. Now understand this. This is the livelihood of these guys. And they throw it overboard. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land. But they observed a bay with a beach into which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes. And they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. Now the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded them, those who could swim, that they should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on broken pieces of ship, so it was that they all escaped safely to land. And so we see that the ship here being broken up, and God again, one last time. I mean, the soldiers are ready to kill the prisoners. Why would they do that? Well, under Roman law, a prisoner that escapes under your guard, you pay his crime. Which tells us that the crime of these guys, they're probably already condemned, these prisoners. Paul is one who is uncondemned, but they're condemned. They're probably not Roman citizens. Paul is a Roman citizen. That's the difference probably between the favor that Paul experienced and what they had. And so, not wanting them to die, again, God spares, God turning, God using the unsaved, well, we don't know if he was saved or not, but we would assume that he's the unsaved centurion, God using him to save the life of Paul. And, you know, the surfers love to point out here that here's your first time of surfing in the Bible. For some came to shore on boards. And so this is ancient surfing. And they arrived there on the shore, but God spared them. They came to land and they escaped safely. They all were saved as God said that they would be. Miraculous things happen on the island as the next chapter goes on, but we will have to wait until next time we are in the book of Acts to take a look at it. Amen?